The following program is brought to you by We Are Many. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.
Well, I have given a bunch of talks before. I don't know if any of them have been any good, so we'll see how this one turns out. And I'm also glad I'm not competing with John Cusack, because that would just not fair. So how many of you have read this book, Left Wing Communism and Infantile Disorder? Show of hands. Okay, so a couple people. How many of you are planning to read this book? Okay, great. So then this talk is perfect for just about everyone in the room. Those of you that raised your hands, you probably know that this is a pamphlet written by V.I. Lenin, the Russian revolutionary. And this talk is really intended to help folks read the pamphlet, understand the pamphlet, understand the history, the context of the pamphlet, and to challenge us to think through how we might apply the pamphlet to the organizing and our action as revolutionaries today. And when reading anything that Lenin wrote, I think it really helps to try to put ourselves in Lenin's shoes. To try to understand the situation, the debates that were happening at the time, what's happening in the movement, and what Lenin's really responding to. It always feels like when Lenin's writing that he's responding and he's arguing and he's in a polemic with someone. So I want to try to start by setting up this context. I think this will help us to understand what is meant by the term left-wing communism and what fuels it, what generates it. Then we'll discuss the particular arguments that Lenin's taking up in the pamphlet. And I'll end by trying to see if we can generalize a method that can be applied to questions of revolutionary strategy and tactics today for us moving forward. And I think it's worth, how many people were at the plenary last night? Okay. So Weill gave this talk on his presentation that night, or his speech was on fighting the right in Portland. And so one way to think of this talk today is kind of like the history, the kind of the background to the kind of questions that Weill was tackling in his talk. And I'll try to end in my talk with taking up that question of in Portland, fighting the far right and fighting the far right. So what is the context that Lenin's writing left-wing communism? The most important backdrop, I think, is really the Russian Revolution, which is a theme of the conference today. It had taken place just about 2.5 years prior to when Lenin's writing left-wing communism. The revolution at that time really proved, and this has been a theme throughout the conference, that an alternative is possible. At that time, the alternative was to World War I, which was devastating to working classes around the world. And the revolution that happened in Russia proved, it showed people that something better is not only possible, it's worth fighting for. So at the same time, Marxists and revolutionaries at the time were very clear that the example could not survive isolated. It couldn't survive under the attack of capitalists that were, sending armies into Russia around the world. The Comintern, therefore, was created to try to facilitate the spreading of revolution throughout Europe and beyond. By 1919, when the Comintern was formed, this was certainly on the table. It wasn't a utopian pipe dream. A general strike and sailor mutiny toppled the Kaiser in Germany. Governments of workers' councils had come to power in Hungary and Bulgaria. And even in this country, in 1919, there was a general strike in Seattle. And then with this mass upsurge, you saw a pouring of new people into revolutionary organizations, becoming what they called social democratic organizations at the time. And this is happening on an unprecedented scale. But as the revolts move forward, from shutting the system down and toppling the old governments, the question of what was to replace them really became the question of the day. And within the movement, there existed primarily, and this is an oversimplification, but there's primarily at that time two answers to this question. One was there were the revolutionaries, and there was the revolutionary answer to this question, represented by the example of the Bolsheviks and the Russian Revolution, who thought that the only way forward to socialism was by the replacement of the current system with a government of workers' councils by means of revolution, the self-emancipation of workers from below. There were also, the other answer to the question was, represented by the reformists, And they believed that socialism had to be instituted more gradually by legislating reforms from above through the government and kind of granting socialism to the people from below. In the pamphlet, it's worth mentioning that the revolutionaries are often referred to as the communists, and the reformists are often referred to as the social democrats. So keep this in mind, you know, in my talks, I think I use the terms rather interchangeably. So in the heat of the revolution, when push comes to shove, the revolutionaries and the reformists who had worked together, organized together, debated together, in the same socialist organizations for years, even decades, you know, for some of these comrades, they found themselves quite literally on opposite sides of the battlefield, so to speak. In Germany, for example, when the Kaiser was toppled and the military was collapsing under the weight of the mass strike movement that I mentioned before, power had been handed over to six social democratic reformist ministers. Under the guise of moderation and a return to order and not going too far too fast, the socialist ministers organized and led counter-revolution, literal counter-revolution, against the workers' councils, against the workers and the revolutionary left. They helped to bring into being an elite paramilitary force of ex-military officers, which would deploy around Germany to put down an uprising of communists. And one particular uprising resulted in the capture, the torture, and the murder of Rosa Luxemburg and Karl Liebknecht, which were two of the most widely known, widely respected leaders of the socialist movement. So these reformists turned out at the height of the revolution to act, as the revolutionaries call them class traitors at this time. They acted on behalf of the ruling class against the working class. These reformists went so far as to murder their former comrades to preserve the institutions of capitalism, which they had entered and were now presiding over. So I say all this because the point of going through that is to put yourself in the shoes then of that new radicalizing, that influx of militant workers. The impact this experience had on tens of thousands of young, newly radicalized, who just joined the socialist movement at the time, they were equally repulsed, not just by the horrors of capitalism, but also the horrors of the reformists and the role that they played. In fact, the reformists at that time had become one of capitalism's main lines of defenses in that revolutionary moment. So the new militants really wanted to tear the head off of capitalism, but they also wanted to tear the head off of these reformist organizations. And there was still a revolutionary urgency. That revolutionary urgency was still there. The revolutionary moment still existed. The possibility for this to happen was still there. So with little training, these new militants applied that experience of betrayal. They applied that anger, that revolutionary urgency to questions of strategy, tactics, and what it meant to organize as a revolutionary. So they wanted nothing to do with, and these are, the words that they used, the reactionary, social chauvinist trade unions, because they were led by the reformists. They argue that revolutionaries should leave them and start their own separate revolutionary trade unions. They wanted nothing to do with the bourgeois parliamentary elections, which were now headed by the social democrats, the reformists. They argued that revolutionaries should leave them and start their own separate revolutionary they argued that the bourgeois elections were obsolete, that they're in the time of the Soviet, and this kind of new workers' government, that why would we focus on something like this bourgeois system of government in this country? I think about it like, in this country we have the election stolen, essentially, by Donald Trump, by the Electoral College, it's a holdover from slavery, right? Like, why would we relate to this thing? They argued against revolutionaries making any form of compromise, any kind of alliance whatsoever with anything that touched the social democrats, the reformists, for any reason, under any circumstance. So this is what the term left-wing communism is about. This is what Lenin, when we say left-wing communism, ultra-left communism, this is what we're referring to. Essentially, it comes down to taking the most left position on any number of questions and refusing to work with anyone to your right. Questions of strategy and tactics are approached as a matter of principle, as opposed to something to be figured out based on an assessment of a particular situation. Well, I haven't found anything in particular that really theorizes this, and if people have suggestions, I'd be very interested to look more into this. I think that the implication is that by virtue of the kind of the purity of their conviction and the correctness of their principles, that broader forces will follow them somehow, become politically awakened, and kind of go with them into the revolution to socialism. So this approach was already having some pretty disastrous results in practice. I don't have time to go into those. But Lenin's pamphlet, therefore, is really an urgent attempt to correct this approach, to prevent more serious disasters and setbacks, and to speed up the development, really, of a new radicalizing layer of revolutionaries to prepare them for the enormous task of fighting for and winning revolution around the world. So let's look at the actual concrete arguments inside of the pamphlet. Those questions of unions relating to elections, and that question of compromising and working with folks to your right. So what is Lenin's response to the argument that revolutionaries should try and organize workers to leave existing trade unions and to form revolutionary trade unions? In short, Lenin argues this is a complete nightmare. It's a disaster for the revolutionaries. First, he argues that while revolutionaries may feel good that they were able to create brand new, he uses these terms, brand new immaculate unions, guiltless of the political sins of the current trade unions, making revolutionary politics a precondition to join a union will in effect cut off the revolutionaries from the bulk of the working class, who may not completely agree with their union leaders, but aren't yet won to revolutionary politics either. Second, Lenin points out that unions are schools for training workers how to fight the capitalists and learn how to self-organize. Think about the education, so to speak, that Chicago teachers gained by organizing a strike against Rahm Emanuel in 2012. They learned how to organize their own pickets. They learned how to read and debate a contract. They learned the lengths that Rahm and the media would go to try to portray the workers as greedy, you know. The third point is that in addition to being a crucial education, trade unions are an essential link between the revolutionary organization, the working class, the broader working class, and then the broader masses. So again, to go back to the Chicago teachers example, think of the solidarity that strikers were able to gain from school parents, the neighborhoods around their schools, the whole city, and even the country. As the struggle became more than just a defense of the teachers, actually a defense of all of us against austerity, the revolutionaries need to be a part of this process, this part of as masses and layers of society go into motion, revolutionaries need to be in touch with this. So at pivotal times like strikes, when workers are learning rapidly, drawing lessons and generalizing, when the bosses are doing everything in their power to divide workers, it would be a huge mistake for revolutionaries to build up another division between themselves and the rest of the workers by creating a competing union. It's like revolutionaries self-imposing exile on themselves, relegating themselves to the sidelines of a struggle where they can do nothing more than to criticize. And no one takes this approach seriously in struggle. The other result is that it allows the right wing of the union to go unchallenged in the day-to-day. It allows them alone, the right wing inside the union, so the Social Democrats in this example, but there are also other people inside unions that have all sorts of consciousness. If you leave the union, what you're essentially doing is letting other forces, Joel Geyer spoke in Socialist Movement, he said movements and struggles abhor a vacuum. That if you're not there, something else, other politics, other strategies, other tactics will be there and will put forward an alternative. In other words, all that leaving trade unions does is it lets backward ideas go unchallenged. At the very time that workers are the most open to radical conclusions. So Lenin argues that revolutionaries must do the exact opposite of what the left communists propose in this situation. He argues that they must do everything in their power to fight for their right to be inside the unions along their working class brothers and sisters. They must resist the attacks, the smear campaigns, and the red baiting from union leaders, and fight for their right to be open socialists, to distribute their literature, to not be censored, Only in this way are they able to truly collaborate, build up a common trust, and prove to broader layers of workers in practice that revolutionary politics point the best way forward. So you'll notice similar themes in Lenin's arguments against the communist, left communist notion that revolutionaries should not participate in parliamentary elections because they had supposedly become irrelevant, obsolete, outmoded, etc. The first point Lenin makes is that how in the world could elections be obsolete if millions of workers are voting in them? In other words, just because revolutionaries see bourgeois elections as a thing of the past and Soviets as the future, doesn't mean the newly radicalizing workers have already come to these conclusions themselves. In fact, the very fact that millions of workers are voting in them means that workers still have hope that getting their people into the halls of power could be a means of solving the economic and social crisis that they're facing. So Lenin argues that the left communists were making a dangerous mistake of confusing their desire for where they'd like working class consciousness to be with an accurate assessment of where working class consciousness was actually at. It would be something like today, you know, saying that the 50% of the US population who doesn't vote are abstaining because they're revolutionaries. There's something there, and we need to figure that out. But it's not true that, you know, if we just called 50% of the population would come with us to fight for. You see what I'm getting at? So we need to start with an accurate assessment instead of wishful thinking. And then we have to try and figure out what we think is the best way to get people from where they're actually at to that next step towards closer to where we want them to be. Like in the case of unions, if workers see a particular institution as a vehicle for fighting against the horrors of capitalism, Lenin argues that revolutionaries must aim to relate to that institution, participate inside of it, alongside workers, wherever and whenever possible. Otherwise, Lenin argues that revolutionaries risk being viewed as mere babblers, and he uses this term a couple times in the book. I like that term. Think about today in this country, another example, or anywhere really, around the world. When literally the whole country is focused on a presidential election every 4 years, when people are following politics more closely than they had been the previous 3 years, we would sound like babblers if all we did was go around and tell people that they're wasting their time putting their hopes and dreams in this institution that is only there to serve the interests of capitalists. Of course, we do want to win people to seeing that the system of elections in this country is serving the interests of capital. We want to win people to the argument that all the great advancements that workers and the oppressed have made in this country have had far more to do with struggle in the streets and struggle in our workplaces. But the question is how and what it takes to get people to that conclusion. Surely it takes more than just babbling at people. So Lenin's argument then is that the best way to win workers to seeing the electoral system as obsolete is by organizing both mass action outside of the electoral system and combining that with the building up of a working class political party inside of which revolutionaries can fight for their politics and perspectives. Unfortunately, and this needs to be said, that this party does not currently exist in the US today. It still has to be built. And if you've been at this conference all weekend, it's a theme of the conference. We need a working class party, not just a revolutionary, but just a party for the working class. The end of this is not gaining more positions for the revolutionary left in government. It is to use the election as a means to agitate and relate revolutionary politics to broader layers of workers and the oppressed. In this way, you can show which means, relying on their own self-organizing in the streets or waiting for elected officials, is most effective in winning the changes that people hope to see. And finally, in addition to providing a means to relate socialist politics to the workers, elections can also be a means of building up networks, of organizing, of forging organizational links between the revolutionaries, between them and the workers and the broader masses, and gaining a more accurate read of what consciousness is truly like. And all of this is necessary, having those relationships, being able to gauge consciousness, all of this is necessary if you want to organize a socialist revolution. In other words, in more ways than one, the process of fighting within the electoral arena is necessary preparation for both the working class, the revolutionaries, and the Revolutionary Party, and a process of getting ready to fight And in the process of learning to win a revolution, in the process of learning how to run a socialist society. So the problem with the Social Democrats was not that they entered the parliament. The problem with reformism isn't that you enter parliament. It's how they use the parliament. It's their strategy and tactics within it, their whole perspective within it, which is consistent with that kind of reformist, gradualist approach. So Lenin shows over and over again that setting foot into and organizing within these institutions where workers politicize is not a compromise in and of itself. It doesn't have to contaminate the revolutionaries and their politics. It is completely possible and necessary for revolutionaries to act in a politically consistent and principled manner while being tactically flexible in order to be relevant, in order to relate to, and to win over the working class. The same is true when making alliances with other non-revolutionary forces to your right in some kind of a common struggle. Combining forces and marching side by side non-revolutionary organizations does not have to mean revolutionaries compromising their politics, but it certainly can, right? There's tremendous pressure, actually. For example, if conditions are placed on revolutionaries that they cannot hold their own banners, that they cannot distribute their own independent literature, that they cannot raise their own slogans, it will be very hard indeed to not compromise. In fact, you are compromising. If revolutionaries hide their disagreements about how best to move forward, how best to fight together, this really is a compromise, and it'll harm not only the revolutionaries, but the actual potential success of the struggle itself. But it's also true that united fronts can be forged, where all are encouraged to march together toward the same cause, each behind their own distinct banners, with disagreements aired and debated out openly, with revolutionaries attempting to show in practice that their politics and their approach is better than the reformist and other folks. And when the reformists try to put the brakes on the struggle and stop halfway, revolutionaries can show that we're willing to continue the fight, continue to push the process forward, and hopefully in that process, winning people around to join us. So again, it's not always easy to accomplish. This is actually very hard to accomplish. It's usually extremely challenging to figure out. But the approach that Lenin is arguing for over and over and over again inside of left-wing communism is that we can be uncompromising, and we need to be uncompromising in our principles as revolutionaries, but flexible tactically in order to be in the best position to relate those principles to the broadest possible layers of workers and the oppressed. But there are times when revolutionaries actually do need to make compromises, when a failure to do so can actually be very detrimental to working class struggle and to revolutionary organization. Lenin gives an abstracted example to make his point. He gives the example of getting held up by a robber. And he says that it's certainly a compromise to agree to hand over your money to the robber. But hardly anyone would fault you for doing so because making that compromise allows you to live to see another day, to continue to move forward with your life. I don't know if there are any sports fans in the room, but you know, I also think about sports. Few successful teams play offense 100% of the time. Even though the point of the game is to score and score more than your opponent, winning teams also have to learn how to defend. So to be against all compromises in all cases on principle is just, it's ridiculous. So the real questions revolutionaries need to ask is when to compromise, and if so, how to compromise in a way that puts the working class in the best possible position, in the strongest possible position to fight again in the future. One example that Lenin uses that I think is particularly useful to think through is going back to work after a strike. As is often the case in strikes, especially these days, the gains that workers are able to win end up being far less than what they originally demanded. Or often even more is the case now that you might not win anything at all. Should they accept the compromise and go back to work? Lenin argues that to figure out this question, it's helpful to be able to distinguish between two types of compromises. There are compromises that workers have to make out of necessity because for whatever reason, the boss's side is stronger than our side. Workers have pushed the struggle as far as it can go and can go no further. That's one type of compromise. But there are also compromises that are made because union leaders on behalf of the workers, end up holding back the struggle in order to advance their own individual strategy of preserving their seat at the negotiating table and trying to bargain on behalf of the workers. In one compromise, attempts to preserve worker agency as they return to work in order to live and to fight another day. The Chicago teachers a good example of that, debating the contract. Where that's the workers taking agency over deciding to compromise or not to compromise. So that's one type of compromise. You preserve your agency, you keep your forces organized, you keep confidence strong through that process. The other is a compromise that removes workers' agency and sets them back so an elite acting on behalf of them can get ahead. So the question we have to ask is this: is there a way that we can fight and win more in that situation? If not, how can we consolidate our forces, rest, regroup, and use the experience to draw the right lessons so that we can fight stronger the next time around? In order to figure out those questions, we have to start with a sober, objective assessment of the balance of forces. This is a term you'll hear us use often. I think someone used it in the plenary last night. This term, the balance of forces, is basically just means that we need to decide what to do based on the best possible estimation of our strength versus the strength of our opponents. Are our forces united or divided? Are our forces confident and militant or demoralized and scared? What are the key political questions right now? What is the history of these kinds of struggle? What kind of power do we have in this situation? Do we have the support and solidarity from the broader community? What about the other side? Are they confused? Are they divided? Or are they united and strong? What length are they willing to go to crush our side? Have they convinced other people around us to turn against us using the media, etc.? Left-wing communists skip these questions completely. They argue that we must use the same tactic every time in each situation, regardless of the answers to those questions, or regardless of the results, oftentimes. Lenin's approach is the opposite. He argues over and over again in the pamphlet, the revolutionaries must base their tactics, when to push forward, when to compromise, when to attack, when to defend, based on our principle of working class self-emancipation. In every tactical decision, we need to think through what will best increase the fighting capacity, the consciousness, and the organization of the working class. This is the ultimate barometer, in my opinion, when considering questions of strategy and tactics as a revolutionary Marxist from that perspective. The question, and I think we just have to return to that question over and over and over again. What will best increase our fighting capacity, the consciousness, organization, and of the working class? So when I first read Left-Wing Communism, I was really surprised how much time Lenin spends on the history of the Russian revolutionary process leading up to and through 1917. Why is this? Why is so much of the book about the revolution, right? It's because ultimately our strategy and tactics must be connected to an understanding of what our goal is and some picture of how best possible we can achieve this goal, how we think we can get there. For the Social Democrats, socialism comes about by getting more Social Democrats into government to get a seat at the table to negotiate on behalf of the workers and the masses. For the left-wing communists, socialism comes about by their own heroic acts against the system. The workers and the masses, hopefully, will follow. In both cases, the working class and the oppressed are relegated to the back seat as passengers along the ride on the road to revolution, while elites, in one form or another, are in the driver's seat. But for Marxists, socialism can only come about when the working class itself gets into the driver's seat and acts as agent in liberating itself and humanity. The only way that the working class can prepare itself for this leadership role is by going through its own experience and struggle, by learning the lessons along the way, not separated from, but alongside revolutionaries. There is no way to skip over this process. The process itself is necessary. Think back to the examples of the pamphlet that I went through. Workers learn whose interest the government is in, not by revolutionaries babbling from the sidelines. They learn by trying everything in their power to get the government to act in their interest. And the more they organize themselves to do so, collectively, through protests to end war, through strikes for better wages and food, etc., the more the government has to dig in its heels and expose who it really serves. And the more workers come to see that their own self-organization is the only way to get things done. This process radicalizes workers. It builds their confidence. It builds their combativity. It prepares them to run society in their own interests. But it's not inevitable either. Oh my God. All right, so I'm gonna be a little bit longer. In almost every struggle, there will be forces like the Social Democrats who want to prevent things from moving too far too fast. There will be bigoted ideas that will divide and weaken the struggle. And there will be ultra-left ideas that may be correct on principle, but do not connect with workers or where workers are actually at, or they may threaten to lead our side into a clobbering by a much stronger opposition. It is necessary that revolutionaries are also there in the struggle to think through what the next step might be that can help to build the combativity, confidence, and consciousness of the working class given a particular situation at that moment. Lenin emphasizes that revolutionaries participating in this way are necessary to help win what is essentially a battle over movement ideas and direction. But he also emphasizes over and over again that only by revolutionaries participating in this process alongside working class people can revolutionaries prepare themselves as well as leaders. So just as the working class more effectively matures and becomes ready to rule and struggle with the involvement of revolutionaries at its heart, the revolutionaries can only develop and become prepared as revolutionaries by going through and learning from the victories, the defeats, by trying to figure out the best next step at each juncture, arm in arm with workers and the oppressed. So left-wing communism isn't a manual on what revolutionaries should do in a given situation to make a revolution, although there's lots of great insights there. It's an argument about the relationship that needs to be forged between revolutionaries and the working class in struggle in the process of fighting for revolutionary transformation of society. It's a question of party and class is one way that we think about it. To wrap up, we have to acknowledge and talk about the 500-pound elephant. I don't know how much 500 pounds. I don't know how much elephants. How much? More, right? It seems like more than that. So it'll be a small elephant. Okay, so let's talk about the dangerous rise of the far right, and how we apply, you know, this talk to this question. On the one hand, we have an elitist liberal approach represented by the Democratic Party, which says that we should ignore the fascists and keep the focus on the midterm elections. Taking back seats in Congress for the Democrats supposedly might suck the wind out of the alt-right sails and draw the fascists back into the holes that they crawled out of. This is the best kind of logic that I can think of what their strategy is. I guess it's the most charitable. Never mind the fact that this strategy of non-resistance, probably most embodied by Hillary Clinton, is exactly what has allowed for the worsening conditions and hopelessness that have fueled the growth of the far right in the first place. After the failure of the strategy to defeat Donald Trump, what makes anyone think that this strategy could defeat fascism? Like during Lenin's time, there's a radicalization going on today against the failed strategies and the squashed hopes of those like the Democratic Party who were once perceived to be on the side of working people. People are radicalizing against this. This means that there's a real opening to pose a left alternative. Unfortunately, though, the most visible alternative that people see right now is another elitist strategy represented by the Black Bloc, which says that the only way to defeat the fascists is through street combat. And if workers were down for that, that'd be great, but they're not. So Black Bloc will fight the fascists themselves with physical force wherever, whenever, regardless of the results. And in fact, one of the major problems with this is the results. At least a couple times, Black Bloc has been outnumbered, out-organized by the fascists. These small stage battles have been giving the far right more confidence, have providing them with the cause to galvanize around, for allowing them to organize themselves further and to develop new leadership. They're developing their cadres through this. For us, Black Bloc is not wrong because they believe that we need to defeat the fascists physically in the streets through street combat. This is a tactic that we should discuss. What is wrong in all of this is that just like the left-wing communists during Lenin's time, Black Bloc is elevating this tactic to a matter of principle. This is even more idiotic because the tactic is proving to have the exact opposite effect that is desired. Further, just like the left communists who would require workers to have revolutionary politics in order to join a union, Black Bloc has managed to repel and cut themselves off completely from forces broader than themselves who also want to see the fascists defeated, but aren't necessarily won to street combat as a tactic. They're demoralizing the left in the process with this losing strategy. And they're disempowering workers and all of these people that want to see Trump go down and fight them, and they're terrified and scared of the fart. They're disempowering people. When keeping in mind our golden rule of increasing the mobilization, organization, and confidence and consciousness of the workers and the oppressed, when you think about the necessity of building a relationship in struggle between revolutionaries and the broader layers of workers, and when you think about the results that Black Bloc has actually had, can you think of anything more at odds with what is needed right now? I want to end by thanking our Portland comrades, and I'm sure by now this time in the conference, there's one in the room, hopefully he'll talk about his experience. Hopefully you've probably heard this story before, but I'm going to go through it again. Because they've really kind of charted an alternative course. Against the directives of Jesse Jackson, who flew into Portland calling on activists not to demonstrate, they organized Portland Stands Against United Hate. And they organized a rally across the street from the far right, far-right so-called freedom of speech, you know, rally, and this was on June 4th. Comrades made the determination that they wouldn't have the numbers to either occupy the plaza, and they didn't have the numbers to push the far-right out once the rally started. So they aimed to confront the bigots with a peaceful rally as a way to try and build a basis for even stronger mobilizations, for greater confidence and militancy in the future, to build the kind of mass force that could actually, in reality, run the fascists out of town. They reached out to unions, faith organizations, immigrant rights groups, social justice groups to endorse the action and invited them to a planning meeting, giving them agency. Is that word again, agency, you know, to shape the event democratically. The planning meeting, I have like just about two more minutes. Cool. The planning meeting had 20 organizations at the planning meeting, and ultimately was endorsed by 72 organizations. And those organizations rallied and mobilized their communities to attend. While everyone agreed to follow what was democratically decided, this did not mean that people hid their politics or their disagreements. In fact, unions, racial justice groups, immigrant rights groups, socialists, and others arrived with their own handmade signs, their own banners, marching in contingents into the rally. This sent an important message. It wasn't only the minority of left-wing activists who rejected racism in the far right, but the masses of ordinary residents of Portland. It also puts forward a model, I think, for the kind of left that needs to be rebuilt in this country. We need a left that is democratic, and forged in struggle, in common struggle, that reaches out to all the layers of folks who may not yet be radical or revolutionary, but really want to stand up and fight the right. Only in this way, through experience and struggle, working alongside each other day in and day out, debating respectfully but sharply, can revolutionaries learn what is needed to fight capitalism and win. And it's the only way that we can win the working class to becoming revolutionary. This is a project that I believe Lenin's pamphlet represents today. And it's the project that I signed up for when I joined the ISO. And I think that you guys should all consider that as well. And I look forward to a discussion of the pamphlet and the questions of strategy and tactics and what we do today.
The preceding program was a production of WeAreMany.org, a website dedicated to publishing radical and activist media that promotes a better understanding of today's world while also putting forward a vision for a better future. We Are Many is a project of the Center for Economic Research and Social Change. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out WeAreMany.org.